My guest today is Celine Haliwa, founder and CEO of Loyal. Loyal is developing a pill that would extend the life of your dog. They would be the first company to get FDA approval for a longevity drug. I couldn't be more excited to have Celine on the show. I think it's going to blow your mind. For full disclosure, a Fundrise fund has invested in the company and therefore has a financial interest in their success. Any discussion of a portfolio company is not intended to imply that the investment will or will not be profitable, or that such company is representative of all investments held by the fund. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Before we get started, I want to remind you this podcast is provided for informational entertainment purposes only. It does not constitute investment advice or recommendations to buy or sell any security. Celine, welcome to Onward.
I'm happy to be here.
To explain to people, what is Loyal?
Loyal is a biotech company developing drugs to extend dog lifespan. So we're trying to get the first drug FDA approved for lifespan extension itself. So just more healthier time with the dog you love.
A pill that makes dogs live longer and healthier sounds like magic.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
I saw it go viral on Twitter the last couple of days.
Yeah, I don't know what triggered that. We didn't do anything. We just started going viral.
Yeah,
this happens like
viral.
Once a quarter.
And people start asking the question that I've been wondering all along, which is what, like, when do people just start like taking it illegally? Like, they just start taking it. They're like, oh, this makes my dog live longer and healthier. Like, I'm going to take it. Tell them why not to do that, Celine.
No comment. So dog biology is interesting. It's like both very similar and also quite different from human biology. One of my favorite drug programs, not that, you know, I have no favorite children, but one of my favorite ones is working on the biological reason why we think big dogs age faster and die sooner. So why my cutie Roddy Squishy only has an expected lifespan of 10 to 12 years, while a Chihuahua, you know, can live for 18 years. That's like especially irrelevant to humans. Like, I'm not living double the lifespan of, you know, basketball players. I am quite short.
Really? I actually thought that like big people did like live shorter lives than small people.
So you definitely get some variance, especially at the extremes, right? So if you're like very, very large, but it's really more that there's some diseases that can lead to this like gigantism. And that definitely will can shorten lifespan if untreated. But like generally speaking, like in dogs, it's actually very strong predictive effect. Like with each incremental pound, their expected lifespan goes down some fraction. In humans, you don't get that.
How does it work? I know you have Loyal 2, and I don't know about Loyal 1 or Loyal 1, Loyal 2. So how does this technology work?
Yeah, so we have kind of two primary categories of drugs we're working on. One is for large dog lifespan extension, which we just talked about. And in a second is for dogs of almost all sizes. So includes smaller breed dogs. And they work in similar but different ways. So the big dog short lifespan drug at a high level, the kind of insight that, to be clear, like predates Loyal and is actually an independent scientific insight, is that the proteins that are activated when a dog is in puberty, so when a puppy is born, they start growing very, very rapidly. Actually, you know, kind of fun fact is that most puppies are born approximately the same size, regardless of what, you know, breed of dog they are. But it's just that these large breed dogs just like double so much faster. Like they're just like growing at such a high rate during that pubescent period. And that's driven in part by these hormones called growth hormones. So there's these little like peptides that circulate in your blood, and they bind to your cells and they say grow, divide, right? They tell the cells to basically like turn over and like split and grow so you can get that larger organism. That's super normal, right? It happens in us and during puberty. It happens in every organism, basically. But what happens in big dogs is that once a dog is fully grown, that pathway, those peptides don't actually turn off. So big dogs still have really, really high levels of these growth hormones circulating in their body saying grow, divide. And that's actually the hypothesis that it's accelerating their rate of aging. So you can actually see mechanistically, like we've done studies in dogs showing that metabolically and in other ways that these big dogs are just aging at a faster rate at a cellular level. And so what the drug does is inhibits the productions of these peptides once the dog is fully grown so that the dog is still, you know, large, but it's just hopefully aging at a slower rate.
very intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I can understand that one. So then how does the other one work?
So the other one is targeting the biology, actually the like most well replicated way to extend lifespan in literally any organism, from like a yeast and a worm and a fly all the way up to primates, is caloric restriction. So basically just reducing the amount of calories that animal takes. And, you know, there's a lot of theories about how caloric restriction works, but at a high level, what's thought to happen is that when you calorically restrict, your body becomes more metabolically sensitive and more metabolically efficient. And so that then has downstream positive consequences on rate of aging, age-related disease development, and therefore the organism lives longer. However, you know, nobody wants to calorically restrict themselves. And crucially, people really don't want to calorically restrict their dogs. There's like a lot of actually like really funny anecdotes about like the failures of caloric restriction, even like weight loss in dogs. And so what the second category of drug does is it activates the downstream biological pathways that are activated when you calorically restrict or when a dog calorically restricts to emulate the benefit you get from caloric restriction. It's called a caloric restriction mimetic, without having the necessity of weight loss or appetite suppression or generally eating less. Which again, in humans, appetite suppression is actually great. That's why like GLP-1s, people love it. In dogs, it's actually not. People really don't want appetite suppression. It does two broad things, the drug. One is that it improves metabolic sensitivity. So basically, if your dog eats something, the ability of the body to use those nutrients efficiently and not have an inefficient nutrient process. And the second is fat tissue function. So, you know, when you see often older people will have like a redistribution of fat in their body. So you'll see like they'll be like really skinny in their arms and their legs, and then they'll have a really big belly. That's not, you know, drinking too many beers, although that could certainly contribute. That's actually an aging phenotype. It's a mechanism of aging. Happens in dogs too. And so it helps reverse that kind of fat tissue dysfunction that you see in dogs to extend their healthy lifespan. And so that's something that's not size specific. So basically any dog mechanistically should be able to benefit from that.
I'm having so much fun hearing you explain how this thing works. I have some idea what you're talking about. I don't want to go too far into the like exactly how the mechanism works, but maybe offline. I remember
always happy to. Yeah,
maybe
it's really
maybe
fun.
On the back end of this, we'll go a little bit more into the technical so I don't lose people too early. But I'm interested. But okay, so let's talk about why this is so exciting, because you are two steps out of three through the FDA process.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're on your way to being the first longevity drug ever FDA approved. That seems like a huge deal to me.
like a huge deal to me too.
yeah. No, I was on some podcast and I was like, we're like, think about it. We have AI, we have space rockets, and we have longevity drugs. Like, we're living in the future.
I know. Actually, my team saw that podcast and posted it in our Slack channel.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah, hopefully. They were like, we love Ben.
Oh,
it was really. I meant to send it to you. It was really cute.
It's so cool. I mean, it's so cool you guys are doing. I mean, anyway, so help explain why this is such a big deal.
So, drugs and medicines are classically developed for a disease, right? And disease is actually a human classification on very complex biological processes, right? So things like arthritis, dementia, cancer, the flu, these are all diseases, right? And so medicines are developed to take a person or a dog or a cat from the sick state back into a healthier state,
mm-hmm.
Or slow the rate of that disease. And so what happens is that can be like really effective for things like, I don't know, strep throat, right? There you take an antibiotic, you go right back to normal. The problem with a lot of diseases of age, so things like, you know, cognitive decline, dementia, many forms of cancer, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, is that it's very, very difficult to treat these diseases, because while you might become symptomatic with cancer, you know, maybe it's stage two or stage three, depending on the type of cancer and a lot of other conditionals, it's often been developing for a decade plus before. And so it's very difficult for a drug or for a medicine or a doctor to like undo it properly. So that's where you kind of get that long, slow, painful decline that we all kind of take as inevitable. And so what's really special about what we're trying to do is that we're not trying to develop drugs against any one specific disease itself. What we're trying to do is broadly keep a relatively healthy, in our case, dog, healthier longer. So we're trying to broadly prevent or reduce risk or reduce severity of diseases, but we're not targeting cancer. We're not targeting arthritis. We're not targeting anything specifically. We're just targeting broadly the mechanisms by which an organism breaks down over time that leads to disease in the future so that we can push off that disease. And that seems like really like natural. Like obviously it's better to like never develop cancer than it is to develop cancer. And then even if you theoretically can cure it, it's still fucking terrible. Right. But it's actually never been a class of medicine before. It's never been considered that you could develop a drug just to keep somebody healthier longer without them having anything overtly wrong with them in the first place. Right. That's really been the domain of like supplements and like, you know, kind of questionable science and questionable interventions. And so it was a really big challenge of ours in the early days. And actually like the early kill point of oil was just like, could we create a regulatory path for a drug like this?
There's so many fun strings to pull on that one, because I've heard you say this and it's so wild how the system isn't designed to encourage building a longevity drug for people. You know, there's all these systemic failures around incentives and regulatory dynamics and the costs. And so could you expand on that for people? Because it's so wild that the thing people would want most were not incentivizing getting built.
Yeah. So before I worked on dog drugs, I worked on human longevity. And before I worked on human longevity, I was actually like the health economics of preventative medicine in humans. It's very difficult to develop preventative medicines in humans for reasons that don't actually have to do with the biology. Like Loyal has not invented any of the science that we're translating and bringing to the clinic and hopefully bringing to market. We have validated it. We've, you know, turned it into a drug and all of these things, right? But, you know, we didn't discover some magical pathway that controls the rate of aging that nobody ever knew about. Like, it's really more of like a translational and a clinical effort. And so all of that science like could exist in and does exist for humans also, right? That is an established biological truth. But to create a longevity drug, the logistics and the operations are extremely difficult, right? So if I gave you a drug to extend your lifespan, how do I know it's working? How do I know what diseases you would or wouldn't have gotten? Maybe you don't live any longer, but maybe you would have had some terrible disease and the drug prevented that. Or maybe it didn't work, but then you get like hit by a bus, right? Or also, who's just going to pay for that? What health insurance company is going to pay for that? Okay, you're on some like preventative medicine to, you know, delay your onset of cancer 30 years from now. But that insurance company isn't benefiting from that financially. It's, you know, Medicare or Medicaid or whoever your like late life insurance company is, which Americans switch insurance companies almost every 2 years on average, right? And so we are in a much more like reactive healthcare system, which like is both suboptimal and makes sense from just like a human psychology POV. But the interesting thing with dogs is that you don't have that problem, right? I call each like dog-human relationship a micro single-payer healthcare system, because I care about Squishy's health today, personally, but also financially. And I care about Squishy's health 5 years from now and 10 years from now, right? And it's all cash pay. So there's no other party involved except for me and the veterinarian and the dog, right? And so I'm willing to invest in something like better dog food, supplementation, eventually Loyal, to keep my dog healthy longer, because I'm incentivized in all of these ways. And the feedback loop is short enough that I also am like, I see the delta, right? I see that my dog I will know in a period of time that my dog is doing better or is not doing better, right? You can see aging in a dog in a way that you don't really see it in humans as overtly. And so it is interesting. Like, I didn't realize this going in, how much of like the drugs that get developed or don't get developed has to do with the logistics and economic incentives, almost more than it has to do with science. Although, to be clear, the science is very difficult also.
Yeah, that's so depressing. But luckily, loyal, because you
at
have
least
a plan.
Our dogs aren't going to have to deal with this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you have a plan. You have a plan within the plan.
I do have a plan within the plan. We have a master plan, in fact. Yeah. So the thesis of the company is like, obviously, first and foremost, we're getting drugs approved for lifespan extension in dogs. I absolutely adore dogs. And if we only extend dog lifespan, like, I'm pretty happy, honestly. And like, from a financial perspective, it's obviously a fantastic outcome. And the kind of unofficial tagline of the company is save the dog, save the world. And the idea is that we can take the, if we can extend dog lifespan, we can take the biological insights, the team, and candidly, the revenue from this to fund the development of human longevity drugs. And let's say Loyal, you know, makes, I don't know, we have hundreds of millions a year of free cash flow in 10 years or 5 years or whatever from these programs. Suddenly you're not beholden to what like a biotech investor thinks it's a good economic bet or not. You're just beholden to what you want to do, right? And what you think is the best like shepherding of that capital. And so we're going to have the opportunity to have a team that is world-class in lifespan extension and the first in lifespan extension and longevity. We'll have all the context from how to do it in dogs, which dogs are the best model of human aging. So if we can do it in a dog, it's not one-to-one, but it's pretty like correlative. And we're going to have the capital to take those types of moonshots. And obviously like that Loyal master plan is very unique, but that kind of broader idea of do something ambitious in like a smaller subset and then use that to fund the next moonshot and then the next moonshot is how a lot of these deep tech companies are built, right? Tesla is like the classic example of like doing the Roadster. The Roadster was like small market, high cost that funded then the Model S and the Model X, you know, much more mass market, but still like a high end car. Then that funded the Model 3, and then they're going down from there all the way to like, you know, as accessible as possible. And it's the same thing with Loyal, right? Very different company, but the same thing of each incremental step teaches you something and funds the next step.
There's so many follow-up questions. Let me just go with the one I deal with most. So I think a lot of CEOs of public companies would say, oh, actually, it's not that easy, even when you're big and you have lots of cash flow, to not, you know, do what the investors want, and the public markets might punish you if you're not like driving short-term yield and short-term growth. Like, how do you think about, I know this is very speculative, but it's sort of a broader challenge for, again, how markets work and how incentives drive outcomes.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
That's funny. It's actually something we've talked about a lot, like the board level of, you know, should we stay private? Should we go public? Like biotech companies often go public pre-approval. And, you know, we're obviously like, you know, well-valued in the private markets, but I think we would actually be valued like much more in the public markets. Like if you just did a discounted cash flow on Loyal, the value today is like much higher than the valuation of our most recent round. Because it's like, we know we're going to get the knock on wood, you know, FDA willing, we have the major keys to get the approval, right? We just need the CMC. So there's a timeline risk and there's a timeline question. But, you know, unless you're fucking incompetent, you know, small molecule drugs don't fail on CMC. They fail on safety and efficacy, right? Which are both.
Oh, man. My compliance team's going to have a heart attack from this section. But yeah, just why don't you explain the three steps that you have to take a drug to, you know, to market?
So broadly, to be able to get a drug cannot be sold for dogs or humans unless the FDA independently says that, you know, we believe this drug is safe and effective and you're able to like manufacture it consistently at scale, right? And so how you prove that it's safe and effective varies from human to dog, but at a high level, you have to show that it's like rigorously safe over time, including at higher doses than you intend to do. We got that safety approval at the end of last year. And that one was actually, I would say, probably the least sexy of the approvals, the most important of the approvals, in my opinion, because we're giving, if this drug's a fully approved for lifespan extension, we're giving relatively healthy dogs who don't have anything wrong with them an intervention to keep them theoretically healthy longer. There's almost no tolerance for side effects, right? It's like GLP-1s. It's like the flu vaccine. It's like, you know, things like that, right? It needs to be basically as safe as milk for the general population. And so we earned that safety approval with an absolute crap ton of data that makes me extremely confident that we are going to do no harm, right? The second thing was then, okay, does it work? And I can go into more details on like the regulatory path if it's interesting, but at a high level, the people tend to think like, oh, because it's a dog, the FDA pathway, the FDA regulation is lower. And that's actually not true. Like the standards are extremely high in veterinary FDA, just like in human FDA, but the paths are different. So we basically are able to launch with a reasonable expectation that the drug's going to do what we say it's going to do. And then we have to show it definitively works within 5 years from that conditional approval. And so we've earned that reasonable expectation, which basically just looks at, it's a lot of things, but it looks at aging in a shorter period of time. So let's think about like, you know, about 6 months, you can see biological aging in a dog. Does the drug impact that? It's a lot more than that. It was like thousands of pages of data, but at a high level, and we got that approval last year also. So then the last thing we have to do to be able to bring this drug to market, in addition to running that full lifespan, the extension study, which we're running and is the largest veterinary clinical trial that's ever been run, is we have to get manufacturing approval. And I like to describe where Loyal is right now, like the continued Tesla metaphor is we're in our Model 3 manufacturing year of hell. Because it's actually very complicated to manufacture pharmaceuticals. Again, it's all like existential technical risk, but it's extremely, extremely complicated. Like every pill has to be the exact same. If you split it in half, there has to be the same amount of drug in the left half and the right half. If somebody in Florida keeps it on a shelf, it has to look the same as if somebody in Alaska keeps on a shelf. You have to quantify exactly what happens if like it gets into a, you know, a truck and the truck gets really, really hot. It's so complicated. It's so unbelievably complicated, but it's all solvable. And so that's where we are right now.
Future cash flows can be uncertain. You never know what's going to happen. So even though we're super confident, anything could happen.
We have no idea how much money this drug's going to make. Like, we might be totally wrong. We might not execute. We cannot launch this drug unless the FDA gives us their blessing. Point blank, period. I cannot sell this drug. Like, we have never made a drip of revenue in 6 years. But also, nobody's ever sold a longevity drug. So we don't actually know how much it's going to make. And I think there's lots of reasons that like we're excited that this is going to be a pretty, that people are going to be really excited about this and want this for their dogs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's very balanced. So for dog or so for veterinary FDA, you can actually launch the drug with a reasonable expectation of efficacy. And then 5 years later, after it's been in market for some amount of time, you get another approval or what happens?
Yeah. So basically you can launch as this reasonable expectation, which is still a very high like data bar, but it's importantly, it's not definitive quantitative lifespan extension. So we have not proven definitive lifespan extension with our drug. We've shown what we believe is like health span improvement or quality of life improvement and like various downstream mechanisms that are, we believe are predictive of eventual lifespan extension and clinically relevant, but we haven't shown definitive lifespan extension. We haven't shown like definitive, like global, like lifespan, health span extension. And that study is really difficult and very long to run. So it's about 1,300 dogs. We're going to follow them for 4 to 8 years, 70 clinical sites across the U.S., run to like very similar standard as a human clinical trial. And so we get conditionally approved, which is like functionally the same, minus like, obviously we have to say it's conditionally approved. We have to like be clear that we haven't definitively shown lifespan extension, but most importantly, the FDA has the right to pull us off market after 5 years. If we don't definitively quantitatively show that yes, we are extending lifespan in the dogs in this clinical trial. And so we have that 5 year period from that conditional approval to show that. Usually you start to study after you get the conditional approval where, I don't know, overeager children and started it sooner. In part because we also just wanted, we don't know how long a lifespan study needs to run in dogs. And we're pretty sure it's going to take more than 5 years. And so we didn't want to like have like regulatory issues with that. So anyhow, that study will run. Once it reads out, hopefully we show definitively that we're reducing mortality risk in the dogs. And then you convert to a full approval. So basically the full approval means that like, unless we find out in 20 years that the drug is giving the dog's elbow cancer, like it stays on market permanently.
Not to get too far off topic, but I know there's been talk about trying to reform the FDA process so the people who want to take the risk, maybe they need to because they save their own lives, or there's some like people get some choice and be able to enter into studies where basically innovators can take more risk to try to, you know, cause more good. Is this something, is this sort of a model of what you were talking about here with how you did it with dogs, or are we talking about something totally different?
It is. So one of the like why nows for Loyal and why I started Loyal was there's a new regulatory pathway that opened up in September of 2019 that was called expanded conditional approval. And it created this regulatory pathway for a drug to get conditional approval if it's for an unmet medical need and a clinical trial is like very arduous, right? This exists, a variation of this exists in humans also, but generally it's for, and I'm not an expert in human regulatory, but generally it's for diseases that are like imminently terminal, nothing exists to treat them. You know, the reward is higher than the risk because, you know, there's nothing anybody can do for that that disease. And so something like lifespan extension or broadly keeping healthy people healthy longer would never qualify for that, right? And it's only because of this new regulatory pathway in 2019 that dog longevity drugs qualified. And they did that because, I mean, I don't think they had in mind that people were going to develop longevity drugs. I do not think that was their thing. But they did that because they're like, okay, if we don't have a regular, my assumption is that they're kind of the regulator's hypothesis was that if we don't have a way for it to be reasonably possible economically for a company to develop a drug that's very ambitious, it's just not going to happen. It's not like they're going to do it and spend more money. It's just not going to happen. And that's totally true, right? Like nobody was going to develop a lifespan extension drug for dogs because nobody was going to run a 7+ year clinical trial, the largest ever clinical trial, millions and millions and millions of dollars to then maybe get it approved, but like, you know, maybe not also because like drugs are hard and developing medicines is difficult. So they created this path where it became economically reasonable, which meant that I wasn't able to pitch Loyal in a way that said, hey, like this is a drug, it's really hard, like don't get me wrong, like it's still gonna cost us a lot of money, take us a lot of time, but it's an amount of time that is like reasonable from a venture ROI landscape, which was just not true if this conditional approval pathway didn't exist. So I actually think like, especially if Loyal succeeds, but even if we fail, I think it's like this whole regulatory path was such a good example of how regulatory incentive design can facilitate innovation because it was so causal. Like it's a one-to-one. If this pathway didn't exist, yeah, Loyal wouldn't exist.
So when did you found Loyal again?
October 2019, I incorporated.
And that was after you saw that change? Yeah.
That was like the last thing because I'd been working on the science. I wasn't trying to start a company, but I'd been working on the biology and the human side and then the dog side. I kind of thought it was an interesting idea. But this was the last piece that made it also a feasible business.
I want to talk about your founding story because it's so fun. It's so good. It's like out of a storybook. But I want to do a different thing first. So I have this thing I like to do when I'm trying to reason through a complex world with a lot of uncertainty is scenario planning. I do it a lot. And there's this whole structured way to do scenario planning from this guy named Peter Schwartz. He wrote this book called The Art of the Long View. And he's famous because, well, probably not famous anymore. He used to be famous because it was a long time ago. Because for doing these structured planning sessions with big companies. And he did one with Shell in the 80s. And Shell then like did this scenario planning. What if the Soviet Union fell? What if the Soviet Union collapsed? And nobody thought that was going to happen. The CIA didn't think it was going to happen. The U.S. military didn't. No one in the world thought it was going to happen. But Shell did the scenario planning, and then they went and went and they saw, they're like, oh man, if the Soviet Union collapsed, it would have these massive effects on the oil industry.
Huh.
And so as a result, they actually ended up planning for that contingency. And then when it collapsed, Shell ended up making like tens of billions of dollars because they were ready. They were the only one ready in the world. So it's like a really fun and I think super useful way to think about, you know, the sort of many paths of the future.
Huh. I just bought it.
Okay. It's really good. And actually,
I'm excited. I'd never heard of it.
Yeah. And actually just like, you know, name drop here. Like I talked about this for a while. At one point, like Peter Schwartz tweeted at me saying like, hey, I heard you talk about my book.
That's so cool.
I replied like, yeah, I'd love to connect. And then he just ghosted me.
RIP. At least he kind of maybe knows who you are. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's got to be older than me by some good measure. So,
yeah, but you're pretty young, Ben. I gotta stop saying that much.
I don't think so. But okay. Anyways.
How old are you?
No. Let's move on.
We're not doing that. Okay, fine. No. I'm the longevity founder. Of course, I'm gonna ask how old you are.
That's true. You need to get that thing FDA approved so I can give it to my dog.
Yeah, you're gonna come back next time, have a fully black beard.
Not
a single gray hair.
I'm gonna be so ripped. Okay, so the structure scenario planning has this approach. So you have three things you do to kind of prepare your mind. One is a good scenario, but the good scenario is not a good scenario. It's actually almost always a linear extrapolation of the present into the future, which is normally how people think.
Yeah, that's fair.
And probably what, you know, you guys have a business plan and you are executing against it. And, you know, you don't expect it to go perfectly well. But, you know, it's more or less like things go well according, you know, and you can extrapolate that out and you say, okay, this is like has a good outcome. So that's scenario one. And it's normally where people live when they in their mind. And then scenario two is easy, but it's normally a bad scenario. Something bad happens. And then scenario three, this is the hard one. This is that something that no one thought would happen happens. And that's the part where people just don't spend enough time thinking about the unexpected.
Yeah.
And it's also the fun part.
What could the world be? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, okay, this is like, you know, and so I could sort of stimulate your thinking on that one. Like, okay, you know, Anthropic launches Mythos and then something else and then something else. And now you're working with an AI on longevity and then the FDA. I mean, there's a, you know, you could get a little out there, but I think it's like the point of it is, you know, Soviet Union can fall, you know, things can happen no one expects. And they usually do. And that's where people are just bad because they're just obsessed with a linear extrapolation on the present into the future.
Interesting.
Recency bias, whatever you want to call it. And so that's the scenario planning exercise. And I every time we have like, I mean, I've gone through COVID, I've gone through like all sorts of bad and some good scenarios I always find if you're prepared, you perform.
I really like that. I'm trying to think like, I struggle with this so much because I do think drug development is. And maybe this is linear extrapolation to your point. So I think I'm going to struggle to be eloquent here. But there's been so many times in drug development where like the world has changed rapidly and then it doesn't really change that much in the biotech drug world, like software. Like obviously software changes, like we use Zoom, like we have like Gantt planning shit, right? But it hasn't like really fundamentally changed how drug development works, right? Like the industry is very slow, but it's also slow for good reasons, right? Like people are like, oh, like AI is going to change like drug discovery. And I'm like, I'm not really convinced. I mean, it will eventually, definitively, it will eventually. But like all the like OpenAI, like, oh, it's going to cure cancer in 10 years. It's like, I don't think we don't understand cancer well enough, right? Like there's actually like really basic shit that we need to do in terms of like quantifying and understanding disease before an AI can do that. And AI is not going to be able to do that because like how, right?
It doesn't have the data sets.
It doesn't have the data sets, right? It's not like Reddit where you can like parse it till the end of time and like learn English, right? And learn like human behavior and communication styles. Like that doesn't exist for biology. It's like so exponentially complex. It's actually like very mind bending when you think about like how many variables go into a certain drug working or not working for an individual patient. We'll see how the world changes. But it's something I've struggled with thinking about how to like prep loyal for it.
Well, let me see if I can like be a Sherpa here a little bit. And on the good scenario, walk through 1, 3, and 5 years, like according to plan, you know, within some measure of obviously of anything that happened, like, okay, year from now, sometime in 2027, is your product likely out to market?
Yeah, just launching, yeah.
Just launching. And then 3 years later, millions of dogs around the country are taking it, living longer. You're like mothered apple pie. You're like on the cover. Don't get on the cover of Fortune. That's the only thing that you don't want that.
Is Fortune like, the like bad one? Is that like where you get jinxed?
Yeah, that's the one that jinxes you.
I thought Forbes jinxes you. Forbes? I was already on the Forbes cover.
Maybe it was Forbes. One of the two. You gotta make sure. Like,
I was on Forbes, so we're fucked.
Oh, damn it.
It was a horrific photo too. I was so annoyed. I was like, come on, guys. Like, if people are gonna quote this photo, like I'd rather not be like a horrible one. Wait, at least let me look hot in my downfall.
Oh yeah, totally. That's key.
I know. I tried to get them to do it with me and my dog, and they wouldn't do it.
Oh, okay. And then 5 years from now, if you have lots of cash flow and the company's very successful and it's widespread and brand's really strong, you're already working on human. You hope to already work on human longevity.
I think sooner than 5 years, but yeah, I mean, really, the only rate limiter to us and human longevity is going to take way longer for obvious reasons. It's going to be way harder, but much more expensive. But the biggest rate limiter, honestly, is just like balancing bandwidth. Like, we're a really small team for the amount of programs and how close we are to market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you have to build an entire go-to-market business that's separate from the technology and the drug development.
And,
yeah,
you know, we're doing own commercialization and own distribution. GLP-1s aside, you don't do that in pharma. And we're doing it in a very like cash minimizing way, right? Like, we're so it's difficult. We have a lot of shit to figure out next year, Ben.
Yeah. Yeah. You're up to it.
Okay, I'm excited.
So let's do a bad scenario because I'm regulated. So I always have to, every time I say anything good, I always have to say something bad. That's like part of the magic of, that's just how you manage regulations.
Otherwise the universe kicks you in the nuts. Yeah.
That's true. Okay. So bad, what's an example of something bad that could happen?
Random adverse event in the STAY study that ends up being causal to the drug.
That would be horrible.
That would be horrific. Sorry, I didn't mean to stress you out.
No, say that. Now say that in English.
Sorry. We find out that there's some rare side effect of the drug that's happening and we only found it after years of the dogs being on the drug and in this, you know, in our big clinical trial, and we end up having to pause or pull the drug.
Yeah, and there's no way to modify the drug or something, and yeah, that would be sucky because it's we'll get there, but it's not just about the company. You're trying to establish a category, and even a super category. You're trying to it's about dogs, yeah, people, longevity, health. I mean, stakes are big.
Stakes are big. I mean, dogs are like people's children. Right. In some ways, people are more willing to take risk in themselves than they are with their children and with their dogs. And so I never want to be responsible for something being in people's dogs that ends up hurting them. Right. That'd be horrific.
Yeah. No, for sure. So let me do unexpected. So I had an unexpected one, and let me just give you an example of one that would be like, maybe this is not good, but this is like, I think the unexpected here actually is sort of asymmetrically good. That's what I'm hoping, I think. And this is my scenario. My scenario is you're working on like your next set of drugs for people, and it turns out all these people have been taking it off, the people have been taking your dog drug off label, sort of illegally, or whatever the right term is. And you didn't know that. Nobody knows that. And it turns out that it has some sort of massive positive effect. And like, or there's some massive unlocking of learning from it, like by accident. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of times, like the whole, I don't know if this is true, but when Louis Pasteur discovered penicillin, it was like an accident, like some mm-hmm. sort of accident around this. And then it, and then like that, that like speeds the path towards longevity drugs, because it's like, it somehow like it shows the market and the world and the regulator something that would have been really hard and slow to do the normal way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a good or bad scenario, but like I could see that being unexpected.
I think another unexpected could just be like massive regulatory change in like how, like so much of how we develop a drug is like human enforced and like human ethical and like societal norms of like what is considered the bar, what risk or not. Like right now it's like very risk off. Like the origins of FDA are, it's a public health organization, right? It's risk little as possible first, then benefit. And I do think we're seeing a little bit of a cultural shift. We'll see if it durates or not. I don't know if it is just like a MAGA thing or if this is like actually like the way society is thinking about medicine writ large is changing. But I think we are seeing a change in like the risk reward tolerances that people are willing to take. And therefore, like, I mean, there's been talk of like changing like the clinical trial norms, how much you have to prove before you do a first in human dosing. I mean, honestly, even if we just brought it to the norms that we have in dogs, which to be clear are still very high, still very ethical, you know, that would massively accelerate human drug development. And that's that would like change a lot of the regulatory capture that we have.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing I think AI will do. I think
maybe.
Obviously anything.
I think it's going to increase the top of funnel a ton. Uh-huh. But I don't know how much it's going to change what actually goes into clinical development. Like, I think we'll have like better drugs potentially, or like it'll be fast. Like, if we know that, like, there's so many targets that we know if we hit them, good things happen, right? So I think we'll go faster from like, okay, we know we want to drug this target, but it's really hard to drug, to like, okay, we have a drug for this target. Like, that's going to be less of an artisanal process. That'll definitely accelerate drug development. But like, running a clinical trial and like selecting the right patients and having high quality data from that and compliant and all these things, like, I think software and like AI, like, we're using AI assisted tools in house to like increase the operational probability of success of a study, which like, it is actually shocking how many studies fail from ops. It's my biggest fear for the study is the operational failure. It's not the biological failure at this point. So I think AI will have a huge impact on that. I don't think it's going to necessarily super change how we run a study, though, in the end, unless the FDA changes.
What I meant, I meant that I think AI is going to change government, bureaucracy, just how people think about decision making. Even risk. Like, I just think I'm optimistic that the best of world happens where people get better at making decisions. They're not that good at making decisions. Sometimes you're good at making decisions in a narrow sense about your thing, and then you're bad at the things away from what you're focused on. Like, so I think that I believe that like AI will actually improve generally how government functions.
That'd be great. I don't know if I'm optimistic, but it'd be great.
It's a low bar, you know. So, okay. Wait, before I don't want to run out of time before I ask you this question. I want to ask you briefly about your founding story, but just you know, you had a lot of people who were interested in investing in Loyal's last round. I think Loyal's just amazing. I think you as a founder, I mean, you're amazing. If people knew your founding story, that which hopefully they'll get to, like, it's awesome. You're like quintessential entrepreneur. But so why do you let Fundrise Innovation Fund into the round? Is there any benefit to having 2 million investors as like potential distribution channel? Like, how did you think about that?
Yeah. Well, big part of it was just you, Ben. Like, I really like you, and you're so like genuinely excited about Loyal in a way that, like, I think Loyal is in 5 years or 3 years or whatever be seen as like an overnight success. But I think like in this like pre overnight success phase, there's a strong and mighty subset of people like you who are like, this is like so obviously amazing. And like, this is so obviously like where the world is going and like so cool. There is a large subset of VCs mostly who just like don't care. And like as a founder, it means so much when you meet people who care on an order of magnitude similar to how much I care, right? It was, I actually felt this most strongly in this round because, it was a good round. It went quickly, blah, blah, blah. But the vast majority of people were basically the vibe was, this is cool, but AI. Like, I'm not going to spend like a single neuron on anything but AI because that is where money is and that is where my partners care and I want like some of that bag. So I'm going to go get that bag, right? And fair. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, you know, like this is, you know, the future is so much bigger. And like the things that needed to be built are so much bigger. And so anyhow, you were never that way. So that was a big part of it. I would say as far as like bringing in the people, it was actually something I've wanted to do for a while. And I was trying to figure out the right way to do it. Because the other group that really understands Loyal, maybe this is just like a damnation on VCs, is the general public. Like we were talking earlier about how we've been going like super viral yesterday. I did literally nothing. Like we don't prompt these things when they occur. It just like somebody writes something and then people are like, oh my God. And they start sending photos of their dogs and everybody retweets it because those keep dogs and it's, right? It goes explosive. The average American, the average human, I would say, cares and is so obsessed with what we're doing and gets it. And I've always wanted to figure out a way to get them involved. In fact, it's like one of the top email categories I get. One is like, get my dog in a clinical trial. Two is give my dog the drug. Three is how can I invest? And so like, I haven't been able and we haven't been able to like, you know, do like a community round yet or anything like that. But like what I learned about Fundrise, I was like, oh, this is perfect. Right. I don't know if and when we're going to go public as like a IPO'd organization for all the things we were talking about earlier. And I think it's like fundamentally unfair that like a portion of the population that like gets into so into it doesn't have access to it. And it's only like the VC class that has access to it. So I was really excited to be able to do that and like bring people in. And of course, I'm sure there's a lot of dog lovers and cat lovers in y'all's ranks.
Yeah. I mean, when you're ready to like get the megaphone, like I feel like our investor base will amplify you like it's nobody's business. I mean, they're just going to be so excited to tell everybody, you know, spread the word, buy it. I mean, so I get it. You're in San Francisco. And so normal people can't understand how venture capital industry players sort of normally work. Because it's so unintuitive that they wouldn't see what you're doing and just absolutely fall all over themselves. Like lately I've been like, like I want to invest as much as we can in Loyal. Like we sit around and we're like, okay, we can invest in like, you know, whatever. There's a few AI companies that are stunningly successful and we want to invest as much as you can in them. And then after that, like, is there any software company left standing after AI? Like, I don't know, honestly.
And
people will ask me, like, what would you do? And I'm like, Loyal. Just like, Loyal is the kind of company that is AI resistant, AI amplified.
So I mean, AI is not going to be able to do this. Maybe one day, but not today and not tomorrow.
No.
So funny. I literally just got an email from Fortune.
Oh, run.
Their ears were burning.
I love Fortune. I'm not trying to be knock on them, but
I'll tell them no cover. No, I think they saw all the stuff yesterday and now they like want a bite of the pie.
Can you just tell your journey here?
I'll give the highlight reel. So I grew up in Austin, Texas. I'm first generation American. First American in my family. My dad's German, my mom's Moroccan. They both immigrated to the US. And like very much not in this world. Like my mom's a teacher, my dad's in contracting. I didn't know anything about anything. But they instituted me with like a love of science and a love of animals. So we had like 15 cats, like 4 dogs. We like would rescue wild animals all the time and like rehab them. I've been vegetarian my entire life. Actually, a lot of people don't realize like how much of an animal person I am. Like people think I'm just like some like human longevity hack, and like it kind of is, but it's I actually like animals more than I like people. It's like the sneaky side story. So anyhow, yeah, was a total like truant in high school. Literally skipped class every week. Had like the sheriff came to my house one time because I wasn't showing up well enough. I was in the bottom 10% of my class. I know, right? I could not get into college for any normal like degree because my GPA was so shit, but I had like basically perfect like test scores. And so I ended up applying to the art school at UT Austin and getting a full ride for art. And then was like, fuck that, I don't want to do art. Because like, I'm okay, but I'm not like a prodigal art person in any way, shape or form. And so I switched to neuroscience. Which, like, fun fact, you're actually not allowed to do that anymore. You can't switch from the art school to neuroscience because, you just, like, I never would have gotten into neuroscience and they never would have given me a scholarship. And then, yeah, I kind of did this random walk of basically realizing that I wanted to work on the lack of free will that we have as humans. And my thought at the time was that, like, what drives our lack of free will, it's our bodies, it's disease, right? You can be like living your life and then God forbid one day you get a brain cancer diagnosis and like whatever you had planned for your life is done. And like for so many of these diseases, you're like there's nothing anybody can actually do. And just the realization that like the adults in the room were actually like unable to be like were powerless against like these rogue cells just like really fucked me up. So anyhow, did this. I was like, oh, I'm going to be like a scientist. I'm going to be a nurse. I'm going to be a physician's assistant. I'm going to be a doctor, right? I was just kind of like learning more about the world and how I was going to work on this problem. Was going to do med school, decided not to do med school last minute because I got an offer to go to Oxford. Went to Oxford, was like, oh, I made it. Like, you know, kid who grew up with nothing. Like now I'm at Oxford, PhD student. Had a kind of terrible time at Oxford for like downer reasons that like I'm happy to get into that are interesting. And while I was there, I got really interested and had like learned about like venture capital and investors. I didn't know anything about investors. I didn't even know about like investing in the stock market, right? And that there's these like crazy people who would put money into scientific ideas because they thought that maybe one day they could be like a new medicine for people. And I was like, wow, that's so cool. Like if you're an investor, you can, with one unit of human energy, facilitate, you know, an order of magnitude more shots on goal for trying to help people, right? And trying to like reduce this like frailty that we have to disease, right? So I cold emailed this woman named Laura Deming, who started the Longevity Fund. She like flew me out, or I flew myself out, I should say, to San Francisco. She gave me a job offer at the end of 2 weeks and was like, drop out of Oxford, join Longevity Fund. I sobbed the entire flight back to Oxford and then kind of dropped out, but I kind of didn't. I just flew back and forth for 2 years. So I was working for Laura and doing Oxford. And I had the idea for Loyal while I was at Longevity Fund. In the meantime, Laura's firing me multiple times and rehiring me, then firing me, then rehiring me again. Long story, but like basically I didn't understand the world and had to learn the world. And Loyal happened because she had worked on this biology of worm aging and worm longevity, which turned out to be very relevant to big dog aging and big dog longevity. And so I just thought it was like funny. I was like, oh, like there's this biological mechanism that, you know, can extend dog lifespan. Like, haha, I know how to extend a dog's lifespan. Like I'm going to extend your dog's lifespan. And I would like awkwardly and autistically like make this joke to people. And I was at like a camping trip with a bunch of founders and VCs, very SF. And I was like joking about this. And some VC there heard about it, then told another VC, who then ran into another VC at YC Demo Day. I never went to YC, but they were like at YC Demo Day. YC will always be a part of the Loyal story, which is hilarious, even though I got rejected like 3 times. Because it was like, hey, I met this girl working on dog longevity. And he was like, oh my God, I have to meet this person. And long story short, they convinced me over like a 6 month period that like this was not only like an interesting scientific idea, but like actually a fantastic company and that I was the right person to build it. And that like it was founder market fit to like the nth degree. I never saw myself as a founder. I never saw myself as a CEO. I thought my like life path was to facilitate, you know, 99th percentile people like Laura. But I thought this was such a overtly correct idea. And I don't know, I kind of felt like it was like predestined to be right and succeed. It just felt, I don't know how to explain it. I just like knew it was right. And I just knew it had to happen. And I knew nobody else was going to do it. And I knew I was uniquely suited to be like at the top, like one of the top founders for this type of company, not for anything to be clear, but for this specific company, I felt like I was like the basically as good as you get. Because of the longevity and the animal love and the arts and the consumer and all of that. And so I started it. And that was about 6 years ago. And it's been like a long, hard fucking journey. But it's also been amazing. And I've never regretted it. Like, I want to do this for the rest of my life.
I want you to, too.
I better. Dude, if I don't have Loyal, I don't know who I'm going to be. Like,
Yeah.
It's like, it's so interwoven into who I am as a human. And it really is like my life story in a company in many ways.
Yeah. And you're young. I mean, I just think over the next 10 years, like, oh my God, I can't even imagine what you're going to do next as part of Loyal, hopefully.
It will. Like the only reason I would ever sell this company or anything like that would be because like that's the only way to guarantee the drug makes it to patients, and it's for whatever reason not going to make it for in any other way. But like this isn't like an interim company to me. This isn't a stepping stone to doing what I really want to do. This is what I really want to do. And 6 years in, I don't have a better idea. And if Loyal disappeared tomorrow, I would just restart Loyal. Because it's like, I still think this is the best and right strategy to develop longevity drugs.
You better call me.
I will hit you up. And that valuation will be a lot more accessible. So maybe you guys should hope for it.
No way. We'll just do the next round. I mean, I just think what you're doing is so fabulous. You're going to keep going. I want to do whatever little part we can to keep supporting you. I want to bridge this gap between the public and private innovators it's been awesome. You're just so inspiring. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Squishy's much better behaved now too. Now she's done pooping on the floor.
Yeah. Okay, Squishy.
She's like, oh, that was hard work.
That was hard work pooping all over your floor. Yeah. Exhausting.
Diarrhea everywhere. Squish.
All right, Celine. Well, onward.
Onward indeed.
You've been listening to Onward, featuring Celine Haliwa, founder and CEO of Loyal. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. If you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise-sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. Thanks so much for joining me.